My name is Charlie Mays, and this morning we're going to be looking at the book of Job under the title, Job, Holding God Accountable. I want to say a word about the premises that I operate under in terms of the way that we've been doing Bible study, or I've been doing Bible study this morning, or this summer at Holden. I've been doing mostly Old Testament studies, and doing them for several reasons. One is that the Old Testament is not a book that we spend a lot of time with usually. Therefore, the stories tend to be fresh and it's easier to teach. People see all these wonderful new things that are there all the time anyway. But also, I'm trying to teach a method of Bible study that perhaps in its assumption about what the Bible is somewhat different than we often carry into our Bible study. I believe that there is occurring in the scriptures conversations, that the Bible is actually holding conversations, debates, arguments within itself, so that you will have a point of view, a theological position held one place that is challenged, refined, nuanced, argued with in other places. And we are going to see some of that, I think, this morning very clearly in Job. It does mean a different understanding than that the Bible is really, in a sense, a book of doctrine that has a consistent theology, that has one thing it wants to say about God and says it throughout. But rather what we're arguing is that the Bible, as it helps us understand who God is for us, gives us various perspectives on who God is. The best way I can illustrate that is perhaps by telling a little story. The church building that served our congregation that I was the pastor of in Fairfax, Virginia, if you had taken someone into that building at night so that they could not see the outside of the building, and when they got inside you turned the lights on, and ask them, what kind of a building is this? What is its structure? They would say, well, any idiot could see that this is a cinder block building. It's very obvious. All we did is paint the inside of the thing, covered it over with paint. But if someone were standing outside that building and you ask them, what kind of a building is this? They would say, well, any idiot could see that this is a brick building. I mean, you can see the bricks. They're right there. The truth of that building, about what the structure of that building, comes when you get both perspectives. It was a cinder block building faced in brick. And so what I think the scriptures give us are different perspectives as we try to understand the relationship of God and the people whom God has called. Now that's just preface. Let me begin my study as I have had a habit of doing, using something from Gerhard Frost, one of my seminary professors. This from a little book called Blessed is the Ordinary. I love a tree. I have a love affair, a very private thing, with one familiar oak. It grows 10 paces from our door, massive and strong and tall. This tree comforts and encourages, calls to me as I leave for my next class. If I had grown from a buried acorn, forgotten by one absent-minded squirrel, perhaps you too, an absent-minded professor, may say something today and then forget, something that may plant an oak in the forests of humanity. So I believe in acorns. This is part of my teacher's creed. Unique among our trees, this oak speaks. It speaks of power and age and deep, deep roots. But most of all, it tells of suffering. In its most stark and visible feature, no major branch grows toward the east. In some harsh moment of a long and testing past, my tree has felt disaster, such force of tragedy that it must live its years without the slightest symmetry, distorted, bent, unyielding in every wind it wrenches at its roots, but holds and stands to greet the dying winds that mark the end of every storm. This special tree, I name it Job. Let us pray. Gracious God, great is the mystery of life, greater still the mystery of suffering, greatest of all, the mystery that we name God and faith. We run too quickly to answers, too easily to shallow comforts, when all we can do is stand and challenge you to be present and to speak. Amen. One of the vows I made this summer was that before the summer was over, I would do a Bible study of Job, not so much for your sake, perhaps, as for mine. And Job is a book I have wrestled with for a long time, and have finally come to several conclusions. First of all, that if I were to find myself among the characters in Job, I stand with and among Job's friends. But there have been moments in my life, and they have been passing moments, when I have been Job. And I think that's true for all of us. And so this morning I would invite you to spend some time struggling with where we find ourselves in this account. Are we Job, or are we among Job's friends? The next thing I want to say by way of preparation for the study is that the image that you need is the image of a courtroom, because that's the setting of this play, of this drama, is that it is set in a courtroom. And the question I want us to wrestle with this morning is, who is on trial here? Who is the accused? God or Job? Now, the next thing I want to say is that there are some very important points in Job that we must not overlook before we get into the story. And I've already hinted at that in terms of who we find ourselves to be. For me, the best commentary I've ever found on the book of Job were a few pages in this book by Elie Wiesel, entitled, the title of the book is Messengers of God, and Wiesel deals with different Old Testament characters and how they are messengers of God. He deals with it out of the context that he experienced the Holocaust as a member of a concentration camp, lost his father, his mother, and his sister. That whole experience told in a moving book called Night, available, by the way, in the bookstore. And so Wiesel, when he moves to Job, in a way that we cannot move to Job. And that is that he and the people to whom he belongs, called the people of God, Israel, have been with Job. And so I'm going to use this book, some stuff out of this book, quite a bit today. Now, let's look at the book of Job. I have a little principle of interpretation, very simplistic, which says that what an author thinks is important, an author repeats. So if they're repeating some things, you'd better pay attention. So let's look at the first chapter of Job. First thing that strikes us, I think, is the fact that Job is legendary. And they don't even tie the legend to a Jewish person. Job is not Jewish. In fact, Wiesel makes a big deal out of this. Who is Job? And so by making Job a citizen of Job is a citizen of the world, every person. And notice how the story starts, as if it were one of our fairy tale and legends. So, you know, if you're hung up over whether Job was a real historical person or not, it's all over. That's not, you can deal with that question after you've dealt with what does this book mean. And if we deal with whether this was an historical person who lived at a certain time and place in ancient history, I think we're going to miss the point that Job still lives. All right? So, and it may well be that's heretical enough that the rest of the Bible study is rendered useless anyway. But But the Jewish tradition is never worried about that question. Never, ever worried about that question. And we get all hung up on it. Now, here we go. There was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job. Now, what's the first description of this man? That man was blameless and upright, one who feared God and turned away from evil. There was born to him 7 sons and 3 daughters. He had 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, 500 she-asses, and very many servants. So that this man was the greatest of all the people of the East. His sons used to go and hold a fast in the house of each on his day, and they would send and invite their 3 sisters to eat and drink with them. And when the days of the feast had run their course, Job would send and sanctify them. He not only was blameless and upright himself, but he acts redemptively on behalf of these children. And he would rise early in the morning and offer burnt offerings according to the number of them all. For Job said, "It may be that my sons have sinned and cursed God in their hearts." Thus Job did continually. Now there comes a day. This interesting little story. When the sons of God. Now that little, the use of this little phrase ought to do something for us in terms of some of the presuppositions we carry to all kinds of phrases in the Bible. Namely, it may well be that when the Bible talks about sons of God, it doesn't mean exactly the same thing we always mean by it. Part of my purpose in Bible study is to untie lots of knots without tying anything back up. And this one knot I want to untie. Because look at who is among the sons of God. Love this story. This is beautiful. So these sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among them. And the Lord said to Satan, "What have you been up to lately? Whence have you come?" And Satan answered the Lord, "Well, from going to and fro on the earth and from walking up and down on it." And God said, "You ever happened to notice Job? Have you considered my servant Job, that there is none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man who fears God and turns away from evil?" Now, the narrator has already told us that Job was blameless, upright, fears God, turns from evil, and now we have Yahweh's word on it, spoken from the very lips of God. Job is blameless, upright, fears God, turns from evil. And Satan answered, "Why, no wonder. He has the best kind of deal. Not even Robert Schuller can come up with a better dealer than this." Right? Why shouldn't he believe in God? He's been reading Deuteronomy and he's been reading Proverbs. And what does it say? The upright person prospers. It's a good deal to believe in you. So what's so big about that, right? Does Job fear God for naught? Hast thou not put a hedge about him and his house and all that he has on every side? Thou hast blessed the work of his hands, and his possessions have increased in the land. But let's just do this. But put forth thy hand now and touch all that he has, and he will curse thee to thy face. And the Lord said to Satan, "You want to bet? Behold, all that he has is in your power. Only upon himself do not put forth your hand." So Satan went forth from the presence of the Lord. Now the scene shifts. And this, you have to really do radio theater here to see this scene, because it's so beautifully told, this story. So Job, the scene shifts from heaven now to the stage on earth. Now there was a day when his sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in their eldest brother's house. That's kind of off to the side. And now there came a messenger to Job and said, "The oxen were plowing and the asses feeding beside them, and the Sabians fell upon them and took them and slew the servants with the edge of the sword, and I alone have escaped to tell you." While he was yet speaking, there came another and said, "The fire of God fell from heaven and burnt up the sheep and the servants and consumed them, and I alone have escaped to tell you." While he was yet speaking, there came another. "The Chaldeans formed 3 companies and made a raid upon the camels and took them and slew the servants from the edge of the sword, and I alone have escaped to tell you." While he was yet speaking, there came another and said, your sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in their eldest brother's house, and behold, a great wind came across the wilderness and struck the four corners of the house, and it fell upon the young people, and they are dead. And I alone have escaped to tell you. I mean, one disaster after another. Now, then Job arose, rent his robe, shaved his head, fell upon the ground, and worshipped. And he said, Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked shall I return. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. Now here's what the narrator thinks of all of that. In all this, Job did not sin or charge God with wrong. Notice, charge God with wrong. We said there's a court scene developing here. Okay, now again there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves. Notice the scene shifts. We just leave that right there, a little comment, and then we go back to heaven again. To present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among them to present himself before the Lord, and the Lord said to Satan, what have you been up to now? You know, whence have you come? Satan answered, from going to and fro on the earth, and from walking up and down upon it. And the Lord said, have you considered my servant Job, that there is none like him on earth, a blameless and upright man who fears God and turns away from evil? He still holds fast his integrity, although you move me against him to destroy him without cause. Now, there's a case building here, and unless we see this, we're going to miss the rest of the book of what it's saying. Again, a verdict from the lips of God. Job is upright and blameless. He has not turned against me, even though we destroy him without cause. Well, Satan said, skin for skin. All that a man has he will give for his life. But put forth thy hand now and touch his bone and his flesh, and he will curse thee to thy face. When it really gets close, when his skin is on the line, then we'll see what this guy is about. The Lord said to Satan, behold, he is in your power, only spare his life. So Satan went forth from the presence of the Lord and afflicted Job with loathsome sores from the sole of his foot to the crown of his head. And he took a potsherd, an old broken pot with rough edges, with which to scrape himself and set among the ashes. Then his wife said to him, do you still hold fast your integrity? Curse God and die. But he said to her, you speak as one of the foolish women would speak. That may be a proof text for not having women pastors. I don't know. But anyway. Hey. That may be just a side issue here, but shall we receive good at the hand of God, and shall we receive and not receive evil? In all this, Job did not sin with his lips. Still blameless, upright. Now, when Job's three friends heard of all this evil which had come upon him, they came each from his own place, Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar, and they made an appointment together to come to console with him and comfort him. And when they saw him from afar, they did not recognize him. And they raised their voices and wept, and they rent their robes and sprinkled dust upon their heads toward heaven. And they sat with him on the ground 7 days and 7 nights, and no one spoke a word to him, for they saw that his suffering was very great. Now, the author has told us that they have sensed what's going on with Job. And then Job opens his mouth, and the artist in this case gives us a reading of the pain that Job feels. And he says, and he closes chapter 3, I am not at ease, nor am I quiet. I have no rest, but trouble comes. I'm in bad shape. Now come his friends. And really with And I see myself as a pastoral counselor. I hear myself saying the same thing these friends did. And it scares me to death here. Let me just read a few things from Wiesel, because he says it very well, and then I'll show you a few texts from the material itself so that you can see whether he's right on or right off or a little of both or whatever. He says, as the two celestial players, God and Satan, withdraw backstage, Job received the visit of three of his friends. At first glance, they did not recognize him. He had changed. They had not. Then they burst into tears, tore their garments, covered their foreheads with ashes, sat down beside him on the ground, and did not open their mouths for 7 days and seven nights. In Job's testament, quoted earlier, his friends did not remain silent, but questioned him a whole week on what had happened. Says a midrash, in deference toward the mourner, one limits his behavior. Job's victors rose when he rose, ate when he ate, drank when he drank. Without ever uttering a word, for certain griefs beget a silence that is commensurate to them. Words could only betray them. We are moved by the three silent friends, but the moment they begin to speak, they disappoint. Talkative, hypocritical. Their emotions seem false, calculated. They had to choose between taking a stand for their beaten and defeated friend or for God. They made the wrong choice. The easiest one. These three self-righteous strangers from afar exaggerated when they tried to explain to Job events whose tragic weight rested only on his shoulders. He suffered, and they made speeches on suffering. He was crushed by sorrow, and they built theories and systems on the subject of grief, suffering, and persecution. I think it's very important to hear that. He suffered and they made speeches on suffering. Let's see what speeches they made. Eliphaz answers first. We'll look in chapter 4, beginning about verse 6, and we'll skip around far, far too much, but hopefully this will entice you to get into the book of Job. It can be read about in about an hour or less, and I think with great profit. Now remember, the narrator and even God, Yahweh, has said Job is upright, blameless, fears God, turns away from evil. You've got to understand that. Now we say in our good Protestant understanding that that's impossible. Person cannot be so good, just, upright, all of that. If you want to hold on to that, you're going to miss the point. The point is, that's not at issue in this story. What is at issue in this story is, how can you maintain faith? And what is faith? It's maybe far different as, like on Monday night when we read the, when Sandy read the thing from James Carroll about when the comforting, this marble statue God of comfort falls and the God of Job's old wrestling stands up. You know, and then Job says, you know, though you slay me, and Carol says, and he will. I won't give up. All right, so Eliphaz says to him, 4:6, is not your fear of God your confidence and the integrity of your ways your hope? Think now. Who that was innocent ever perished? Or where were the upright cut off? As I have seen, those who plow iniquity and sow trouble reap the same. What has Eliphaz just said to Job?
You deserve it.
I've never seen a situation in my whole life where an innocent person suffered. So the folks who do evil, they get evil back. Now, he says, if I were to give you some advice, over in chapter 5, verse 8, as for me, I would seek God, and to God would I commit my cause. I'll give you an illustration of this. We had in the parish in Virginia a woman who was going through a nervous breakdown. Very, very devout woman. And another devout woman with a slightly different theology said to her one day, she said, if you would just pray about it and turn this over to God, you would get well. And Jenny said, and you'll have to pardon the language here, but this is a direct quote. She says, how the hell do you think I'm getting along this well? Okay? Then we have this little thing that finds its way, I think, if not onto Hallmark greeting cards or ones that Augsburg sells. Behold, happy is the man whom God reproves. Therefore despise not the chastening of the Almighty. For he wounds, but he binds up. He smites, but his hands heal. That's said as comfort. Then notice how the speech ends, the end of chapter 5. Hear and know that it is for your good. That's a lot of comfort, right? You're suffering and I'm making speeches and it's for your good. Be assured of that. And then notice what Job says. Verse 4. The arrows of the Almighty are in me. My spirit drinks their poison. The terrors of God are arrayed against me. And he goes on to talk about, like in verse 13, in truth I have no help in me, and any resource is driven from me. He's in utter despair. And then he talks about these friends of his who have come. In verse 14, he who withholds kindness from a friend forsakes the fear of the Almighty. My brethren are treacherous as a torrent bed, as freshlets that pass away, which are dark with ice and where the snow hides itself. In time of heat they disappear. When it is hot they vanish from their place. The caravans turn aside from their course. They go up into the waste and perish. And then he says, and skipping to verse 21, such you have now become to me. You see my calamity and are afraid. Then he goes on, verse 24, teach me and I will be silent. Make me understand how I have erred. And so he asked them for some kind of presence, some kind of comfort. Then there's an interesting thing, and Wiesel makes a big point of this also in his work. It's to raise questions right now. That's all we want to do is raise up the questions that Job is dealing with. Look at chapter 7, verse 17 and following. What is man that thou dost make so much of him, and that thou dost set thy mind upon him? Dost visit him every morning and test him every moment? How long wilt thou not look away from me, nor let me alone till I swallow my spittle? If I sin, what do I do to thee, thou watcher of men? Why hast thou made me thy mark? Why hast thou become a burden to me? Why dost thou not pardon my transgression and take away my iniquity? For now I shall lie in the earth. Thou wilt seek me, but I shall not be. In other words, if I sin, what's that to you? That's kind of a cosmic question. I mean, why should God get so upset if we should sin? Okay, Job is full of questions. Then Bildad comes, and he comes with his theology. Verse 3, does God pervert justice, or does the Almighty pervert the right? I believe that's one of the deepest questions in Job, because that's what Job wants to know. Does God pervert justice? Does the Almighty pervert the right? I mean, here is a blameless, upright, God-fearing, evil-turning-away-from person, and he suffers. Is that right? Has God perverted justice? Then he also has a word of comfort in verse 20. Behold, God will not reject a blameless man, nor take the hand of evildoers. That's real comfort, right? He will not reject a blameless man. Job feels utterly rejected by God. All right. Then Job answers in chapter 9. And again, the court scene. He wants a word from the Lord. That's what he wants. So he says, though I am innocent, this is verse 15, though I am innocent, I cannot answer him. I must appeal for mercy to my accuser. If I summoned him and he answered me, I would not believe that he was listening to my voice. For he crushes me with a tempest and multiplies my wounds without cause. He will not let me get my breath, but fills me with bitterness. If it is a contest of strength, behold him. If it is a matter of justice, who can summon him? In other words, I don't have a chance against God. my physical strength cannot stand against him. And in a court of law, it's like some slick Philadelphia lawyer against a country bumpkin. But I want him to speak. Want God to speak. Verse 32, chapter 9. For he is not a man as I am, that I might answer him, that we should come to trial together. There is no umpire between us who might lay his hand upon us both. Let him take his rod away from me, and let not dread of him terrify me. Then I would speak without fear of him, for I am not so in myself. Then Job goes on to talk more about the bitterness that he feels and all of that. Then his third friend speaks, and you maybe noticed a pattern. Friend speaks, Job speaks, friend speaks, Job speaks. And so it goes. In chapter 11, Zophar speaks, and his argument kind of could be summarized in verse 4 and following of chapter 11. For you say, my doctrine is pure, and I am clean in God's eyes. But oh, that God would speak and open his lips to you, that he would tell you the secrets of wisdom, for he is manifold in understanding. Know then that God exacts of you less than your guilt deserves. I mean, if God gave you what you deserved. And the thing that scares me about that, I went through an experience with some people that are very, very close to me, and one of them would keep saying, you know, why is it? We have not been all that bad. And I said, because they were close enough in family to say, well, you know, if we, you know, sinful as we all are, if we really got what we deserved, then it would really be hell to pay. Zophar, can't believe it. Can you find the deep things of God? Can you find out the limits of the Almighty? It is heavier than heaven. What can you do? Deeper than Sheol, what can you know? Okay, then I want to share a Semitic simile with you. One of the things the Bible is so far much more creative than we are in terms of coming up with beautiful imagery, I think, and this has nothing to do with the argument necessarily, but it's just a kind of a neat figure of speech. In verse 12 of chapter 11, "But a stupid man will get understanding when a wild ass's colt is born a man." In other words, you're never going to wise up unless a wild ass's colt is born a man. A donkey produces a man. You know, that's an interesting little fat chance. Yeah. Anyway, the other way around, we often think that happens, that humans have asses for children. Okay, chapter 12, Job answers, "No doubt you are the people and wisdom will die with you. But I have understanding as well as you." I mean, I can figure out what's going on. "I am not inferior to you. Who does not know such things as these?" Then a thing in verse 5. "In the thought of one who is at ease, there is contempt for misfortune." When you're out there having your picnic and talking about all the people that are starving in the world, there's contempt for that. Must be their fault, right? Ever heard that argument around? If they just quit having so many kids, if they didn't have their stupid Hindu laws, they'd have enough to eat? Oh, yes, there is contempt for misfortune in those who are at ease. It is ready for those whose feet slip. And then he goes on, "The tents of robbers are at peace, and those who provoke God are secure, who bring their God in their hand." I mean, things are turned upside down. Then in chapter 13, verse 3, "But I would speak to the Almighty, and I desire to argue my case with God. As for you, you whitewashed with lies, worthless physicians are you all. Oh, that you would keep silent, and that it would be your wisdom." I think beautiful statement. Then in 13, verse 15, "Behold, he will slay me. I have no hope, yet I will defend my ways to his face. Even though, you know, to stand in God's presence will be the end of me, I'm going to stand up to God." That's what Job is saying here. All right. It's, you know, time is fleeting, so we can't go through all of the arguments, but I just hope that's enough of an introduction so that you can get some feel for the arguments that are going on, and it goes back and forth of their accusing God or accusing Job that somehow or another he must have sinned, trying to figure out what what the meaning of his suffering must be, and Wiesel's statement is right: Job suffers; they make speeches about suffering, you know, they continually come back to this accusation that we know because we heard the preface to the story. We know that he is innocent, that God counts him to be innocent, and yet they keep accusing him. Then at the end of chapter 31, we meet an interesting little thing, the very last words, and which has led scholars to believe that we have an interpolation of some material that has been stuck in here. It says, the words of Job are ended. Then we have this fourth person that comes in, Elihu, and he's a young Turk. Says, as verse 32 or chapter 32 begins, "So these three men ceased to answer Job because he was righteous in his own eyes." Well, not only in his own eyes, but God's as well. Then Elihu comes up, and he was angry at Job because he justified himself rather than God. He was angry also at Job's three friends because they had found no answer, although they had declared Job to be in the wrong. And so he had waited to speak because they were older than he. And then he starts this speech, "I am young in years and you are aged, therefore I was timid and afraid to declare my opinion to you, but now watch out, because I'm going to give you both barrels." And so he kind of goes through all of the arguments that that they have all held, and he lays everybody out, as it were. And then in chapter 34, again, I'm just skipping. Would that Job were tried to the end, because he answers like wicked men, for he adds rebellion to his sin. He adds rebellion to his sin. He claps his hands among us and multiplies his words against God. Then he has this kind of arrogance in chapter 36, verse 2, the last part of it. Bear with me a little and I will show you, for I have yet something to say to you on God's behalf. He speaks for God, as if God cannot speak for himself. And then when he finishes speaking, and this is one of the ironies, I think, then God kind of says to him, Elihu, would you step off the stage, please? Shut up. I'll speak for myself. Now, Weisel says, interestingly, when God speaks for himself, it is of no help to the issue at hand. God waltzes in with questions about creation. Job's not interested in creation questions. So, chapter 38. Then the Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind. Who is this that darkens counsel by words without knowledge? Gird up your loins like a man. I've got a few questions for you. Where were you when I laid the foundation of the earth? And then they go through these questions, and then God gets sarcastic with Job. Interesting story here. And in 31:28, he's asking him questions. Oh, we'll pick up in verse 19. Where is the way to the dwelling of light, and where is the place of darkness, that you may take it to its territory, and that you may discern the path to its home? You know, for you were born then, and the number of your days is great. Do you see the sarcasm in that? I mean, you know, here's puny little Job, whose days are numbered, and God is saying, well, you know, you were around when I created all this, weren't you? I mean, now you make all these big statements. There's a real sense of sarcasm, in this kind of thing. And like in the questions go on and on. 39:1, do you know when the mountain goats bring forth? Do you observe the calving of the hinds? And do you remember the months that they fulfill? And do you know the time when they bring forth? And in other words, do you know that their gestation periods even? I mean, after all, I created them. I know that. You don't. Then in chapter 40, verse 3, Job ventures an answer. He says, behold, I am small of account. What shall I answer thee? I lay my hand on my mouth. I have spoken once, and I will not answer twice, but I will proceed no further. Then God comes back with a whole bunch more questions. Will you even put me in the wrong? This is verse 8. Will you condemn me that you may be justified? And that's really, Job is about that struggle. And we know in one sense that Job's on the right side of the argument. Job is an innocent victim of some kind of a cosmic contest. What justice is there in that? And then God goes on to ask him more. I love the questions. If you see him, I think, with some sense of humor. What about going fishing? Let's think about that for a minute. Verse 1 of chapter 41. Can you draw out Leviathan with a fish hook? Or press down his tongue with a cord? I mean, that's, you know, they feared the great Leviathan. And God is saying, I could go fishing for him on Sunday afternoon, no big deal. And can you put a rope in his nose or pierce his jaw with a hook? Piddly stuff. What are you talking about, Job? Then chapter 42, which ends the book. Then Job answered the Lord, I know that thou canst do all things, and that no purpose of thine can be thwarted. Who is this then that hides counsel without knowledge? Therefore I have uttered what I did not understand, things too wonderful for me which I did not know. Hear, and I will speak. I will question you, and you declare to me. I had heard of thee by the hearing of the ear, but now my eye sees thee. Therefore I despise myself and repent in dust and ashes. Interesting. He finally has gotten God to speak. That seems to be the point of this. Then we'll look at the end of this, and then I want to share a few things from Wiesel, and then we can talk. After the Lord had spoken these words to Job, the Lord said to Eliphaz, "My wrath is kindled against you and against your two friends." See, the scholars think that probably Elihu's interpolation is later in the text, because he doesn't say your three friends, but two friends. "For you have not spoken to me, not spoken of me what is right, as my servant Job has." And then it tells him what to do. And then notice the end of verse 8. "For you have not spoken of me what is right, as my servant Job has." And then Eliphaz and Bildad and Zophar went and did what the Lord had told them to do, namely make some sin sacrifices. And the Lord accepted Job's prayer. Now, I think it's very important that we hear those words. The Lord accepted Job's prayer. Now, Job's prayer has been a prayer of complaint, of questioning the judgment and the justice of God. That's been Job's prayer, which God accepts. Then we have this tremendous blessing that comes to Job. And then I think it's interesting that in the midst of all of that blessing, it says, "And Job died, an old man and full of days." That birth and death are part of that whole blessing of God. Now, let me share with you a few things that Wiesel says, which I think help to keep the book of Job open and alive for us. He says, "I was preoccupied with Job, especially in the early years after the war. In those days, he could be seen on every road of Europe, wounded, robbed, mutilated, certainly not happy, nor resigned. I was offended by his surrender in the text. Job's resignation as man was an insult to man. He should not have given in so easily. He should have continued to protest, to refuse the handouts. He should have said to God, 'Very well, I forgive you. I forgive you to the extent of my sorrow, my anguish. But what about my dead children? Do they forgive you? What right have I to speak on their behalf? Do I have the moral, the human right to accept an ending, a solution to this story in which they have played roles that you imposed on them, not because of them, but because of me? By accepting your inequities, do I not become your accomplice? Now it is my turn to choose between you and my children, and I refuse to repudiate them. I demand that justice be done to them, if not to me, and that the trial continue.' Yes, that is what he should have said, only he did not. He agreed to go back to living as before. Therein lay God's true victory. He forced Job to welcome happiness. After the catastrophe, Job lived happily in spite of himself." Now, Here is Wiesel. He's got a few more words about Job's capitulation and how it's understood not really as capitulation, but a continued perseverance in resistance to the. But here's the way he sums up the story of Job. "Once upon a time, in a faraway land, there lived a legendary man, a just and generous man, who, in his solitude and despair, found the courage to stand up to God and to force God to look at his creation, and to speak to these men who sometimes succeed, in spite of God and of themselves, in achieving triumphs over God, triumphs that are grave and disquieting. What remains of Job? A shadow? A fable? Not even the shadow of a shadow. An example, perhaps." I think what Wiesel knows, because he's Jewish and he lives in the scriptures, is what we, because we do not live in the scriptures, do not know about God. And that is that God invites us to bring all of life into relationship with this God. Not just the pleasant parts of it, and not just the parts of it that we understand. I use this example a lot from our own household. One of our children has the kind of relationship with Sandy that allows her to say, "I hate you." And we've tried over the years to say, better say, "You're angry with your mother." Oh, she's that too. "But I hate you." And then in 3 minutes to ask mother to be there to tuck her in. Now I believe, at least this is how I've tried to comfort my wife who suffers with this and I do not, that is the ultimate kind of confidence in relationship. To be able to hang it all out. And without even being able to articulate that I can trust this relationship so much that I can say, "I hate you." And I think the book of Job invites us into that kind of depth of relationship with this God. Who finally, there was one other Job in the Bible who dies an utterly senseless death. Not because of what he had done. Who was railroaded by religious and civil authorities to a death which he tried to escape. "Father, remove this cup." And who finally, in the midst of the dying, says, my God, why have you forsaken me?" We call him Jesus. A blameless, upright man who fears God and turns from evil. Dies an utterly senseless death. I think, in many ways also, the history of Israel as a people is the story of Job. Now we want to say, "Well, they sinned this way, they sinned that way." To miss much of the point, certainly they have. But when you look at it in another way, and I think that's true for the faithful of God in many places and in many moments of history. And the book of Job, I believe, invites us to reject all the easy answers. And to say, I think this is part of the meaning of the incarnation, that if you have to choose between defending your helpless neighbor, friend, and God, God would rather have you defend the neighbor. Isn't that what Jesus Christ did? Okay, we've got about 8 minutes. You can deal with the heresy and all else.
I listened to you talking about Job, and I'm also thinking of the good news that you spoke about to Germany, is that we will be stopped. And I'm just trying to juxtaposition what is, in fact, punishment from God, consequence of our ways, and what... Where do you make the trade, Charlie, if you think about it?
Well, one of the things about being being some kind of a biblical teacher is the fact that you just teach what this one book says and you don't worry about all the connections. You don't have to be systematic. But this gets back into my theme that I wanted to introduce at the beginning, is that I believe there are conversations going on in the Bible, and that the best I can do is to listen in on those conversations and know that there are times when God visits us because of our sin. But also there are times when suffering seems all out of proportion. In other words, and if you read the book of Job, you will hear Job saying that why is it? Why is this world such? If God is a just God, created this world, etc., to be good and all of that, why do the scoundrels seem to make it so they die? You know, they go to sleep every night and they don't twist and turn on their beds, and we have all this anguish, and etc. If this were really if God were really in control, God were really just, then things ought not to be this way. And there's that side of things also. Why is it that some drunk We've got a guy in the Seattle area that's had like 44 arrests for drunk driving and finally killed somebody, and he's still out. Now, what's just about that? And see, that's not a visitation on the victims of that for their sin. I think the Bible wants us to stay away from that. It does want us to say, however, that for ourselves, we'd better be very careful. I mean, we do stand under judgment, so it's both and. And we can say of ourselves, I deserve the just, I deserve the punishment. If Job had said, I certainly must have sinned, I believe I could hear that. But you see, it's like all of these glib answers we give to people's suffering is that it's always given by those who are not doing the suffering. And if I want to say, in the midst of my suffering, that God is just, God is good, God gives, God takes away, blessed be the name of the Lord. The sufferer can say that. I don't think the person who stands outside the suffering has a right to say that. That's a long way of getting around not answering your question. Because I want it to stand in tension. Okay, any other? See, I think biblical faith, and that's finally what the book of Job is about. It's about faith, because as soon as you enter into a theistic understanding of life, an understanding of life that posits a God of any sort, you have to deal with the question of evil, the question of suffering. And so I think the question gets to be, in the midst of enormous suffering, how do you trust God? Can you trust God? See, suffering, in one sense, is not the problem. God is. If this is just a world in which things happen randomly and without, just by whatever laws of nature or the capricious whims of whatever, then suffering really is not a problem. I mean, it's just one of the things that happens. But if you inject God into the picture, then, you're tied. It's like I had a ministry to a woman that was raised in the Swedish Lutheran Church, very devout, pious woman, was involved in an automobile accident with her husband in Alabama. Some drunk person hit them. She had severe limitation of circulation to her feet or legs, so her legs, she was in constant pain. And she would sit around and watch the PTL club and the 700 club stuff, and watch all these people who had prayed to God and God answered their prayer and they were all healed now. And she was, I mean, she really earnestly worried about that, and she prayed about that, and she turned her life over to God, and she did all the things they did, and still she was in pain. Now her problem comes down really to two things. One is, either there's something wrong with God, because God does not answer my prayers, and I've done everything I'm supposed to do by what the Bible says and everything. Or there's something wrong with me. Now, her piety would not allow her to exercise the first option. So her emotional state and everything else was far worse off. She was judged by that kind of theology of glory that you get Jesus and everything comes out okay. The New Testament tells us we ought not to trust that, because what happened to all the disciples of Jesus, with the possible exception of John, not a one of them died a natural death. So this idea about getting Jesus and getting one's problems neatly solved is not biblical on any at all. I mean, think about what it means to try to sell something. You're out selling stuff that means you may not make it a natural death. That's hard stuff to sell. I wonder what the early church was up to, don't you? It's certainly not what we are up to oftentimes, because we sell a religion of comfort. And ultimately, I suppose in one sense we could say it is, but not the way we expected it to be, because what God offers us is an abundant life. life with the fullness of God's life itself. And the fullness of God's life consists in the fact that God suffers with his creation. I've given this little speech a lot, but you ever think about John 3:16? For God so loved the world, which has not yet been canceled. His love, at least, and the world continues to do what we do to one another. Do you think it's fun being God? If you have that kind of love for creation that continues to foul everything up, I think what it means to be God is to suffer ultimately. Think of those of you who have children. When your children are fouling up or getting hurt. And God has an infinite number of such children. I think it's a painful process. It's the one job in the universe I would refuse. Being president of the United States or something, I might even entertain that. But not to be God. If the scriptural witness at its heart is correct. Okay, it's coffee break time, and I've succeeded in doing most of the talking. Hopefully this will open up the book of Job, and you can prove me totally wrong. That's fine. Just enter into the conversation.